Grand Canyon University makes earning your degree possible with over 130 academic programs for traditional campus students, with more than 80 bachelor's programs offered online. GCU provides you with the personal support you need, from complimentary unofficial transcript evaluations within 24 business hours to scholarships, academic support, and your GCU graduation team led by your own university counselor. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was good!
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
And Julie, popcorn, I've really been thinking a lot about advertising recently.
Yeah.
Just in all the ways that it gets inside our head, popcorn. Mm-hmm. And how the next thing we know, we're just out there buying the products that these big companies want us to buy, popcorn.
Yeah, I've heard about this with sort of messaging that's subliminal. I don't really think it exists. I mean,
no.
Gosh, I'm kind of getting hungry. But I mean, when I think about it, I always think about the 1950s, right?
Yes, indeed. Basically the term for subliminal messaging goes back to James Vickery, and he was a market researcher, 1957.
Yep.
So I'm instantly thinking, sort of Mad Men era type of stuff.
Right. Somewhere in a room smoking going, I got a great idea.
Yeah. Though I guess Mad Men's a little later than this, but anyway, he was big on the idea of like let's insert some images into these movies in New Jersey, and we'll just get right in their brains. The next
right.
thing you know, they got it. They're going to have Coca-Cola or even popcorn.
That's right. Yeah. That's the message, right? Eat popcorn and drink Coca-Cola.
Yeah, and they were flashing this up for 1/3,000th of a second. So it's just flash like to the point where supposedly you wouldn't even register.
Right.
That you saw it, but your brain would know it. And then your brain would demand popcorn and Coke.
Of course, this resulted in a whole new era of advertising, because people were just nuts about the subliminal advertising.
Yeah. And a lot of paranoia too.
Yeah.
Because it's the whole idea. It's like, you're inserting a random image and you're reprogramming my brain.
Right. You're trying to manipulate me and the government's involved and so on and so forth.
Yeah. And, of course, a lot of it turned out to be kind of bunk.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he actually, didn't he claim that, popcorn sales went up by 18% or something like that? Or no,
yeah,
57%. But this was a lie. Yes.
Yeah. He said the Coke sales went up by 18% and popcorn 57%. So
yeah.
It's just, according to him, it's just like people aren't even finishing the movie. It just turns into an orgy of popcorn, munching out in the lobby.
Right. People are so excited about this. And between 1950 and 1970, it's all the rage until.
Yep.
Wah, FCC.
Yep, they banned it.
Yeah.
And you continue to see uses of it and alleged uses of it pop up. There was an instance in, a George W. Bush campaign bit that supposedly had a little bit of subliminal messaging thrown
right.
in there that some people got up in arms over. And then there's the whole, side tangent of satanic subliminal messaging and the, you know, the paranoia over that.
Right.
I was pretty much dismissed.
I can't remember which political figure this is. I can't believe I can't remember this right now, but it was a big brouhaha because they were filming him and there's a bookcase behind him, but it was configured in such a way that somehow, like, the interstices of the bookcase seemed to suggest a cross if you looked at it.
Oh.
Which, you know, they said, okay, that's just a coincidence. That's not really a cross behind me. But it was fascinating because I was like, you know what? That does look like a cross. So, yeah, I mean, whether or not it's meant to look like that or people are mean to be inserting subliminal messages, it's still out there.
Exactly. So, I mean, the big thing here is that, like, anytime you're trying to sell a product or an experience or even a podcast, even though we don't charge for this thing, you're going to level any kind of skill you can level to try and make people buy it or buy into it. It's kind of like the whole argument that wars, between armies, wars are won based on accumulating, tiny, relatively insignificant advantages, petty advantages. And if you accumulate enough of these, then you can win the battle. And so, you know, obviously marketers are going to use everything they can, everything from studies to throwing in maybe something subliminal, little touches like that. And as we're going to explore in this podcast, different, stimuli to affect our sense of smell,
right,
our hearing, our sight, and then where is this going in the future, right?
Yeah. How are we playing with these new technologies?
Yeah.
You know, are we actually aiding and abetting advertisers? And that's what we're thinking of. Like, what are the different ways that we're being manipulated at this very moment and also submitting ourselves to be manipulated by? And to that end, I want to talk about scent.
Yes. Scent is a big one. Our very sense of taste is, like, a large percent of it is smell. I mean, it's
right.
Wherever you go, smell is going to play a huge role in what you take in. We end up I don't know if you ever get this sort of like a, not really a deja vu, but like a smell memory. Like, suddenly you'll smell something and you'll instantly be able to go back to where you remember smelling that. Like,
right. That's actually called the Proustian effect. By Marcel Proust. I'm sure you know of the author. His novel, Remembrance of Things Past, was the first to explicitly link smell and memory.
Ah.
So he talked about the emotional power. I think it was Madeleine cakes and how that called up his images of his childhood.
Yeah, I'll be walking down the street and suddenly I smell inexplicably the like the house that I lived in when I was seven or something, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And it'll be the kind of thing where you could never... Like, you can't really access this catalog of smells, or I can't normally, but then suddenly it's out of the blue and I'm like, hey, there's the link is made.
Well, and that's because the odorant patterns are interpreted as different smells in the olfactory bulb, right?
Mm-hmm.
And because the olfactory bulb is part of your limbic system, which is our emotional center of the brain, smell is closely connected to the amygdala and the hippocampus. And those are both structures that influence our behavior, our mood, and our memory. So you do have that little storehouse going on there. And it's really effective, right? You know, real estate agents always say to bake cookies or, you know.
Yeah, or to spray the fake cookie smell, right?
Yeah, you know? Yeah. Because, you know, that encourages people to linger more, have those cozy feelings of cookies being cooked.
Huh.
Yeah. But marketers, of course, have figured this out. And they've, in a big way, right? Like, it's a science for them. They've looked at how people are responding, the best smells, like, are there universal smells that people respond to well? And they figured out all these different ways to employ that in different retail spaces. So if you go into a French-themed store, you might smell hints of lavender, which are just trying to underscore the fact that you're in a French store, I suppose. Or you might go into a home goods store and smell chocolate chip cookies.
Uh-huh.
But it's not just making you feel, you know, nice and cuddly inside, right? I mean, there's an effect here.
They're buttering you up, right?
They are buttering you up because they know that if they pump out those aromas, that you're going to spend more money. In fact, there was one study that was conducted in a Canadian mall. And they found that there was an increase of over $50 per customer that week.
Huh.
And that's from the author Martin Howard from We Know What You Want.
Huh. Well, I forget how I came across this. You know how you end up doing internet searches and you end up getting off course a little. But I found all these threads where people were trying to figure out what the smell was in Subway sandwich restaurants. And people were like, what is that smell? Or and then I think some people would have been reading some of the same material we are, and they were like, oh, they're pumping it in. They're brainwashing us with their fake chemical scents. And then somebody finally entered the conversation and was like, well, actually, it has something to do with the way they bring in like frozen yeast and not frozen yeast, frozen dough, and then they have to thaw it before they cook it and bake the bread. But it's an interesting way of thinking of things.
Yeah.
Nothing nefarious. Nothing more nefarious than freezing dough. So. It depends where you fall on that, I guess.
So it was like accidental marketing, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you could imagine like a situation where, say, they changed, say Subway sandwiches were to change their method.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly you didn't have that smell. Like, there might be an advantage in figuring out a way to bottle it and pump it in.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I swear that the Gap has its own signature scent because, you know, it's not that I hang out at the Gap a lot, but anytime that I've bought something from there and I've brought it home, it still has that scent attached to it. And it's a pleasant scent.
Yeah.
But I'm always like, God, that's that Gap scent.
Well, you know, new car smell is another big one for people.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you go on that test ride in that car, it smells so new and nice.
Right.
I mean, I'm not particularly, you know, enraptured by it, but I know many people are.
No, you're right. And then like you've got your reptilian brain all excited and thinking, ooh, car.
I do request it when I go to like the Cactus Car Wash to get the car. You know, they have the bottles and they're like, which one do you want? And I'll be like, fresh, you know, new car. And they're like, we're out. And then I have to make do with like kumquat or something.
Strawberry shortcake.
Yeah. And yeah, something weird.
But. Yeah. Yeah. I thought I smelled that in your car. Yeah. But it can actually go awry, though. In 2006, California's Milk Processor Board launched a series of Got Milk billboards in San Francisco bus shelters. So the print ads also featured the scent of chocolate chip cookies. And they reasoned that people would smell the chocolate chip cookies and then they'd want some milk and it would all work fabulously. But people actually complained about it. And, think about it. That's a situation where you've got incongruent elements going on. You've got the smell of the streets and passersby, maybe they're smoking. And, you know, in my own experience, you know, if you're sitting in a bus shelter, it might smell like urine sometimes. So,
yeah.
You
know, that's like the Candler Park MARTA station here in Atlanta. It's really close to a some sort of industrial baking facility, right?
Yeah, actually, it's I can't remember the pie maker, but yes,
yeah.
Sara Lee or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, so it's like, so you're there and it'll smell either like cakes baking, pies baking, or pies baking and like urine. You know, it just depends, you know, or whatever the train terminal smells happen to be. So yeah, you end up with a weird mix there.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually tried to take a tour of that factory, but
you were arrested.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I was just going to say they didn't let me, but fine. Yes, I was arrested.
This presentation is brought to you by Intel, sponsors of tomorrow.
And then there's music, right? We already know
music
how music can manipulate you.
I mean, we used it at the start of this podcast.
That's right.
You know, it sort of hopefully gets one in the mood and you know, you go to any fine dining establishment, you're generally going to be, you're paying for the ambiance as much as the food.
Yeah.
And so a huge part of that is the music. Let's play some music that makes people relax, makes them calm down. Makes them feel like, you know, they're somewhere special. Like, you know, this is the evening's entertainment.
Yeah. And, you know, Muzak, right? You've heard of Muzak.
Yes.
Which I think most of us associate with elevator music. That's a huge company. And they actually create all sorts of different nuanced types of tracks depending on what your retail business is.
Mm-hmm.
And there was actually another study, again, author Martin Howard had talked about this, that specially designed music loops can keep shoppers in the supermarket for 18% longer.
Oh, wow. Like the song never ends, so you never leave?
No, I think it was just sort of like if you maybe put, I don't know, like Enya in a supermarket.
Yeah.
Like maybe it would just slow down people's actions.
I don't know. There was a time where that might have kept me going, but.
Yeah, no, it would speed things up, I suppose.
It's really amazing, though, how many places don't get this concept, though. You'll go into, some types it'll be something like a, you know, the kind of place where you get, like, your nails done.
Yeah.
I mean, not that I go to these places a lot, but I have on a rare occasion been to one. And they'll, you know, they'll totally have their skill set down, but they won't understand that you should maybe play music that doesn't make you want to strangle yourself.
Yeah. And I've actually noted this before in breakfast places.
Yeah.
Sometimes they'll play extremely loud music, like really bad 80s music. And I think, oh my God, really, like, not that I'm hungover, but some of us here might be hungover. It's not the right choice. So yeah, we know already. We talked about this a lot too in Can Music Rebuild Your Brain? How music can affect you.
Yeah. It
mostly positively.
Yeah. It leaches in and changes the way you view the world.
Right.
I mean, it's just across the board.
Right,
so it makes perfect sense that you would want to leverage this in a marketing situation.
Right. You would want someone's reward center in the brain ding, ding, dinging and releasing dopamine, and you'd be feeling really great and you might buy more. But another advertising technology that's creeped up in the last couple of years is beaming advertisements into people's ears, which is super creepy. I'm sure you all have heard about it before. But it's called an auditory spotlight.
Yeah, and this is we actually have a really cool article on the website by John Fuller about this, and it's basically what it sounds like, just directional, like you're just directing the sound at a particular area where a person would conceivably be, and they're hearing the message, right?
Yep, that's right. That's actually a tiny beam, just like light, and it's a beam from a rooftop speaker.
Yeah. Now, so I really don't know that I've encountered this in real life.
No, I haven't either. And I wonder if it's just been used in larger cities or if it was just, you know, 2007, 2008 seemed to be its big years.
Yeah.
And I think the main brouhaha was in New York when A&E was promoting a show called Paranormal State. And people would walk by and a woman's voice would say, "Who's there? Who's there? It's not your imagination." And people started to get creeped out, of course. But I really haven't seen it being used outside of that, you know, like outside of actually museums and libraries, places where you need it to be quiet and you need this directed sound.
Right. And the other thing about this technology, I think it instantly, the idea and the headlines associated with it instantly captivated everybody because it brought to mind the idea that they are beaming visual advertisements directly into your brain, which is a gag that's featured in one of my favorite Futurama episodes where, where Fry is having this dream that he's in his underwear, and it turns into an advertisement for underwear. And then he wakes
within his dream.
Yeah, within his dream. Yeah. And he wakes up and he's like, "What was that all about?" And they're like, "Oh, it's just how it is, we all have advertisements in our dreams." And you know, it's like we joke about that, but you know, some of the technology coming along is really getting it's really getting into your head, and you can see a future where a lot of this is going to be kind of intrusive.
Yeah, and we're talking about MRIs actually again. I feel like we talk about MRIs all the time, but they're being used everywhere all the time for everything.
Yeah, and this is where we're looking at the brain while someone is thinking, and watching the movement, watching how blood moves around, and just seeing the neural architecture in action.
Yeah. And I think at first, you know, of course, they were doing this for many reasons that, you know, science, medical based, but, you know, those crafty marketeers, started to try to figure it out. I think, in fact, they're now calling it neuromarketing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, what they have figured out is that you can map the data. You can look at someone's thoughts, right? Like someone, for instance, the 60 Minutes piece that we watched, a person was looking at 10 different objects. And then the MRI was scanning that.
Mm-hmm.
And then what they did is they took that data, fed it to a computer, and then told the computer later on, okay, well, here are two objects. Based on that one scan, what is this person looking at?
Yeah, and stuff like, is it a knife or a house, right? And then they would be like, it was a knife. And then we're like, oh, the computer got
that's right.
Really right.
So the brain was saying, I'm looking at a knife. That's the first scan. Second was a house. Third, a hammer, so on and so forth. And the computer was given two choices, from what I recall, and saying which one was this person looking at, and the computer was choosing right almost every time.
Right.
Of course, there are some oddities that happen because your brain might light up differently, say with a hammer, if you've had a bad experience with a hammer. So.
Yeah, it's like every brain is going to be a little, and it's like a fingerprint, you know, it's a very complicated fingerprint, so it's not going to be perfect. But they can also look at it in terms of which of two decisions is someone going to make.
Yeah, trying to predict.
Yeah, which with marketing, that comes down to a very basic decision. You know,
right.
It's like, is this person going to buy this object or not? Are they interested in this, or are they repulsed by it?
Right. And this is, and Carnegie Mellon was looking at this, right? And they were actually trying to have the ability to map nuanced thoughts within like the next 3 years. So yes, this idea of not just saying, okay, we, based on this information, everybody's, there's universal qualities, right?
Right.
That, come up when you look at an image. And so everybody's going to think about this object this way most of the time.
Right.
But no, I mean, it's more than that. It's like, what choices are people going to make?
And where have you been? Another one they looked at was, you know, it's like we have these sort of mental images of places.
Uh-huh.
And they can, you know, answer the question, have you seen this environment before? Mm-hmm. And that has there's a whole possibility there with, like criminal investigations. Like, you know, were you at the scene of the crime? Well, we just scanned you and it said you were. In fact, EEG was used to convict a woman of poisoning an ex-fiancé in India.
That's right.
Yeah.
Because they were describing the circumstances around his death, and at the same time she was getting scanned,
right?
And they said, oh, okay, we see all this activity going on.
Now, you can sort of lay that on her for agreeing to the scan, because that's the other big thing we have to mention here. When we're talking about getting scanned, it's one of these situations where it's like getting an MRI. You know, you're laying down, you're being really still, very cooperative, while this you basically go in this giant donut.
Right. Right. As far as we know, governments, corporations cannot stuff us into this donut and make us do this.
Even in Total Recall, they had trouble keeping Arnold Schwarzenegger in that chair. You know, he ended up breaking out of it. So,
well, he's Arnold Schwarzenegger,
right?
Yeah.
So we either have, that's the thing. So we're going to either have to develop stronger chairs, or develop scanning systems that are that don't demand so much cooperation.
Portable ones.
Yeah, portable ones, and ones that can just sort of scan you in a second.
Right. And then there is a man named Paul Root Wolpe. He's the director of ethics at Emory University, and he says this is possible, that you can beam light into your front cortex and that receptors would get the reflection of that light, essentially reading your thoughts that correspond what you're looking at that time.
Yeah, so we'd be able to do it not only remotely, but also covertly, you know, like you might be, I'm just throwing this out there, like you're looking at the billboard at the train station and it's looking at you. You don't even realize that it's gauging your reaction to the advertisement. And maybe based on those readings, it might be able to throw up something that interests you more or interests you or would, you know, interest you, well, not interest you less, but, you know, it would be able to, if you've ever filled out like a survey online, or these basic like, recommendation engines that say like, oh, you like this movie and this movie, well, you'd probably love this.
Right.
You know, as wrong as Netflix seems to get that, on my account, you know, it's like that's the sort of thing that everyone seems to be interested in. And this would be like a laser shining, a laser, but like a beam of light shining at your head. And then, you could easily imagine a computerized system that would then give you recommendations based on your reaction.
Well, that's what I was thinking. I was thinking, okay, maybe I'm at the Gap, you know, it's five years from now, I'm at the Gap. I happen to be looking at a red shirt and, you know, the beam of light, it gets that information, then it interfaces with a marketing company, which then, you know, real time tells the salesperson, get more red stuff. She loves it, you know? Uh-huh. And it's interesting to think that might happen, but it's also, I also feel like in this day and age that, you know, I don't necessarily want that to happen, but I feel like I'm giving up so much of my own information to advertisers already just to get a quick fix, a quick, you know, 10% off of something, that I'm almost a willing participant, you know, and I can see this sort of thing being used in the future where it's like, okay, well, if you buy into our light beam program, well, you get an extra 20% off of your purchases, you know, and then I'm complicit in this act.
Well, you know, it's, I can easily see it. It's because on one level, it's easy to imagine people like, I do not want machines reading my mind and trying to sell me things. But I mean, we're already letting machines read our personal emails and give us little ads, you know, over to the side in our Google accounts.
Right.
So I could easily see a situation where you would be like, yes, I will let this computer that somebody has assured me, is going to, you know, keep my secrets. I will allow that to scan my brain and give me movie recommendations.
Right.
God only knows what kind of movie recommendations we would get on an accurate scan of our complex thoughts. Because that's the thing. Neuroscience is saying within the next 5 years, the same technology that's enabling people to say, hey, are you thinking of a knife or a bowl of pudding, will be able to decipher some much more complex thoughts.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's kind of amazing to think of it that way. And also, there's that element of gratification. Like, we want instant gratification. We want it now. So, if there's the promise of that, then we're willing to exchange something of ourselves for it.
Right. And it, you know, you really begin to think too, is the technology includes, will we reach the point where, various forms of entertainment respond to, the way that, to our brain scans.
Yeah.
Like maybe you're in a restroom, say you're in a private room, right? Maybe there's a scanning system that can tell if you are digging the music and either, you know, shift the mix to, accommodate you or even shift the music itself. You can get into the whole area of intelligent music where there won't be a composition as much, but a composition that changes according to your neural requirements.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, I mean, it just, the sky's the limit. Movies that sort of write themselves, you know, depending on how you're responding to it, in your brain.
Huh. I kind of dig that, actually.
Yeah.
I
see, now you're coming around.
All right. Yeah. Here's all my personal information in exchange for that.
And then, I mean, as long as we're talking about things that we can manipulate in the brain, I mean, our brain has these different pleasure systems. For instance, there is a portion of the brain known as the, orbitofrontal cortex, and this is where the joy one experiences during sex or you know, eating a really tasty sandwich take place.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, they've been exploring ways to manipulate that, mainly
of
for
course.
Things like treating like Parkinson's disease, you know, or various neurological conditions. But of course, marketing eventually pokes its head into any research facility and starts dreaming about ways you could use it. So imagine that, like, you're in a store and you're suddenly just feeling really great about this purchase you're about to make. Now I think that would probably be invasive, but.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're working on this, sex chip thing, which supposedly.
And they are calling it the sex chip,
yeah, they are
right?
Calling it the
like
chip.
The new Viagra.
Yeah. And they're, you know, hoping to say help people with a condition called, anhedonia. Yeah, anhedonia,
mm-hmm.
which means you can't feel joy in regards to sex and food. And so they would treat this by putting a chip in. But that's like just creating a chip for that is years away, much less right. The idea of some sort of external, you know, laser device that's going to beam joy directly into your brain.
So the idea is that this implant, right, is going to be stimulating the orbitofrontal cortex.
Right.
And so I'm just trying to imagine, like, you know, wearing that during intimate moments. I mean,
or just on the train, you know, to work in the morning.
Right.
You know,
and people be like, look, I see what you have on. I know what you're doing over there.
Yes, you see, but what if we all had them? Like I can imagine a situation where everybody gets these installed so you can better interface with your movie that writes itself, you know?
Yeah.
It's like it's writing itself based on how you're responding to it. And it's also pumping you with pleasure every time there's a, you know, a shot of a slice of pie on the screen.
Wow. You just never would have to leave your home.
Never would.
Yeah. According to a Scientific American article that I read, Stuart Malloy, a North Carolina physician who specializes in implanting spinal electrodes for pain mostly, or to relieve pain rather, he found by chance that a slightly off-kilter placement in the lower spine caused one woman to exclaim, "You're going to have to teach my husband how to do that." And here we go.
Yeah.
He has actually created a machine explicitly for what we're talking about. And it's a modified spinal cord stimulator. And the name is really subtle.
Yeah.
It's called the Orgasmatron.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That sounds fake, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's actually, I think it's an homage to Woody Allen in the film Sleeper.
What was the device in Barbarella?
I do not recall.
There's like the scene where Duran Duran has Barbarella in the... I don't know. It has some sort of crazy name. It looks like a big organ. I need to see
that
again.
We'll just call it the organ, yeah. Or maybe not.
Yeah.
That's an unfortunate name.
It is.
Yeah. But I don't know. That's some technology that's far off, and it's kind of crude sounding right now, right?
Yeah, that's Barbarella territory.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, yeah.
You know, we'll get there eventually.
Yeah, yeah. But again, it begs that question, like, what are we willingly allowing ourselves to participate in?
Yeah.
And it made me think about this new interface that students at MIT Media Lab have developed. It's a wearable computing system that turns any surface, your arm, table, wall, whatever, into an interactive display screen.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and the wearer can summon virtual gadgets and internet data at will.
Just on their arm.
Yeah.
Is like
if you were like, what time it is, you could just draw a watch and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh.
It's very cool. Their goal is to harness computers to feed us information in an organic fashion, like our existing senses. So it's this idea that computers might become our sixth sense. And in fact, I mean, it's so nuts that, you could encounter someone at a party and the system would project a cloud of words onto that person's body and provide more information about that person, like a blog URL, the name of his company, likes, dislikes. I know.
Like we become our Facebook profile.
Pretty much.
Like the end of the black hole where the mad scientist and the robot merge into one horrifying thing.
Well, that's what I was thinking. I mean, not specifically that.
That would be amazing.
But I was thinking, like, that's the juncture of where advertisers and ourselves, like, come together, right?
Yep.
Because you know that in that situation that you're, there's no privacy, right? Like, you're sharing everything about yourself in exchange for the ability to move throughout the world in a more fluid way.
Right.
It's a little scary. And again, I know I've brought it up before, but it's like super sad true love story in which people wear an apparatus or apparati around their necks and it gives everybody's credit scores and so on and so forth.
Well, no, you're allowed to continually pimp the books that you really like.
I do. I keep being reminded of that story. It's super true, super sad, and it's a love story.
Well, excellent. Well, Popcorn, I'm going to turn to our listener mail now. We have a couple here from some listeners.
All right.
Here's one from Nathaniel.
Just going to have a snack over here.
Okay.
You do that.
All right. I was listening to your awesome podcast on alien abduction, and I realized that something similar to that paralysis thing was going on. On occasion, I will wake up during a moment of pain in my dream, such as being hit in the face with a baseball or being kicked in the chest by a thug. At this moment, I wake up with intense pain all over my body at some horrible hour and typically can't fall asleep again. I don't know if this is unusual and was wondering if you could use your epic minds and power to explain this. Huge fan, love the show, and you will never cease to figuratively blow my mind. Well, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Well, one possibility is that thugs are kicking you in your chest during the night, and I would look into that possibility first.
Yeah, it's happened to me before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Beyond that, we'd have to look into it. I mean, it certainly sounds offhand like it's similar to the phenomenon where supposedly we have this evolutionary holdover where we're afraid of falling out of trees and being eaten by ground predators. And so that we'll, if we feel like we're slipping in our dream or falling over, like I'll have it where I'm like slipping on milk or something, and then I'll just fly awake.
I think you've been hanging out with sloths too much.
Yeah.
I mean, the sloths, the monkeys.
I did see a monkey fall out of the tree in Costa Rica.
Oh.
Yeah. Plummeted. I mean, just fell. Not just like a little fall, but like a really embarrassing fall.
Was the monkey okay?
Yeah.
Embarrassing.
I think he was embarrassed.
He would be ashamed,
The tourists were all watching, and he just falls out of the tree.
Maybe that's part of their trick, you know? They're like, all right, now you're going to fall. And we'll get a gasp from the audience.
Well, Nathaniel, I will say that we do need a we will return to the world of dreams in a future podcast. I'd really like to do one with having to do with nightmares and night terrors specifically. So we'll keep you posted on all that. So we have another listener mail from someone who wishes to remain anonymous. And he writes in, I'm a long-time listener, first-time writer, and I have come back from a trip to Japan where I just happened to listen to your episode, Is Your Gut a Genius? On the sixth day of battling a bout of constipation. While this happens basically every time I leave the country, as you could imagine, after 6 days, it was pretty irritable, and I was getting pretty anxious about being clogged up for so long. But listening to the podcast and finding out that this happens to most people, along with you guys, providing an explanation for it, just seemed to lift the anxiety immediately. Don't know whether it was the fact that I now understood what was happening and my brain talked to my bowels, or whether it was just me, but suffice to say that before the podcast was over, I did the deed as nature intended.
All right.
Unfortunately, it was using a Japanese-style toilet on a moving bullet train. However, I was grateful nonetheless. So, I'm glad to know that some of our listeners find our podcast so moving. You know?
nice pun there. I know, and that makes me think about something called the sphincter law, which we don't have time to get into now, but it's definitely something that I think we need to talk about in some other format.
Okay, well, look for that title to show up in your iTunes or Zoom.
The law of the sphincter.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, hey, if you have any tales of toiletry terrors on the on your travels, then you know, stop by our Facebook page where we are Blow the Mind, and we're also Blow the Mind on Twitter, and we update that feed pretty regularly with cool happenings at How Stuff Works, discovery, and just neat stuff we find out elsewhere on the web.
If you have any questions or you're interested to find out more about some of our research notes or links that we've used in this episode or any others, feel free to drop us a line at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The How Stuff Works iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Gene Fodor!
Gene, was good!
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.